I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Well, hello there, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Geraldine Doogue. It's lovely to have you company tonight. And I would like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of this land, and to pay my respect to their elders past, present and emerging. Now, we're here to converse with two men who had a rather memorable conversation, or an unusual one, I think it'd be fair to say, in December last year on ABC Radio National.
Jonathan Swan is a national political correspondent at Axios and joins me now from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to breakfast.
Hi, Dad.
We'll leave that till later, darling. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
Jonathan Swan is a national political correspondent at Axios and, yes, a blood relative.
So, yes, I am here to speak with the two Swan men, Norman and Jonathan. Neither have books out as such, though one will soon at the end of June. But the point is you're all here. It's a full house for two remarkable men of our modern era, it seems to me, father and son. They've both become household names, men of journalism and the information age. I've had the privilege of watching them both. I've watched the man there, Jonathan, who's joining us from his office in Washington. I've watched him grow up I've watched him as
grow
a boss.
Grow up as well.
As grow up as well, still growing up. A co-host and a very firm friend. I'm going to assume that you would like to know more about these two men. What sort of family produces two such achievers? It's a family with a wonderful mother, Lee Sutton, who I think is here tonight, sisters Anna, George's in Singapore, and now their husbands and partners, Betsy, Mark and Chris. Now, it was a good eastern suburbs life, really, for the Swans as a family. Never dull, because life is never dull around Norman. Not for long, anyway. Family is vital to them, I think. Vital. Even though Norman and Lee aren't married anymore, but they've been through a lot together, all of them, at the micro and the macro level, you might say. And I'll canvass some of their peak experiences and maybe some at the other end of the spectrum as well. It's a rich, full life that we're about to discuss tonight, and I'll leave time for questions too at the end. So now, Jonathan and Norman, 2020 really was the most extraordinary year for you both, if I think about it, where your careers absolutely exploded, if one could use that cliche. I wonder what it was like to feel yourself in the middle of this whirlwind, to sense something was amazing was underway, which you hadn't really predicted. I mean, you, Jonathan, in that final tumultuous year of President Donald Trump. But I'd like to ask you both to start. On reflection, did you realise you were in a game-changing time? Norman?
No, I kind of walked into it. I do remember in March going out to dinner with friends, and there was just this normal conversation, and it was like, I thought, this is like September, you know, August 1939. And I thought, you don't know what's about to happen. And there was just this surreal experience, but it was more surreal than I thought it was going to be. The pandemic was worse than I thought it was going to be. And just kind of walked into this vacuum, and and the rest is history, as they say.
Well, you've been warning me about pandemics for years. You said we were overdue a pandemic, and then it arrived. And in fact, I remember at the time.
You didn't want to hear it.
I didn't. I said, oh, well, Norman, I can't imagine it's going to be that bad. Well, I have rethought.
Yes. Yes. Geraldine doesn't like to panic.
She doesn't. She doesn't like to panic. Now, Jonathan, what about you? I mean, you'd been there you'd been through 3 years of Trump, but that final year, were you readying yourself for something truly remarkable? And then we'll talk then about after the election, which is another story again. But on reflection, do you think you had an instinct of what was coming?
No, God, no. I mean, I thought he was not coasting to re-election, but probably going to get re-elected. People forget that. I mean, December 19, January 2020, the economy was booming in the US. Unemployment was at record lows across all demographics. And Donald Trump was in an extremely strong position. He had the entire Republican, unlike 2016, he had the entire Republican Party at his beck and call, completely subservient to him and united around him. And he had, frankly, we had the prospect of a Democratic socialist in Bernie Sanders winning the Democratic primaries. People forget Joe Biden was done. I mean, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, he got beat, and his team were, you know, he'd run out of money. He had no operation in any of the Super Tuesday states because he had no money. And he gets this come from, you know, this remarkable victory in South Carolina. And, you know, if it wasn't for COVID, you know, there would have been much more time spent analyzing his comeback. It was one of the most remarkable comebacks in modern American political history. I mean, the party went, holy shit, we're going to have a socialist. We better consolidate. They dropped out of the race. Like, it was like lightning speed. You had Buttigieg and Klobuchar. They all drop out. They all endorse Biden. The whole establishment gets behind him and they crush Bernie. And so that's where my head was at, was this race and focused on that. I mean, I remember early March, right? I was in Florida interviewing the head of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez. You know, we're shaking hands, we're in the room, you know, there's all the people around, whatever. And then, you know, 2 minutes later, not 2 minutes literally, but in, you know, a week later, the country shuts down. And Trump is, you know, like giving this terrified speech to the nation. He looked really spooked. And he'd just come out of this Oval Office meeting where he'd basically been told the world was falling apart and we've got to shut down, you know, he'd already shut down China travel. He had to shut down Europe. And it was this moment where he saw his world that he'd had in his head running on the economy, all this stuff just fall apart. So everything just changed like that. And, you know, as you know, I mean, you're all in this crowded auditorium. I haven't been in a room, like I'm seeing you guys on the thing. I haven't been in a room like that for more than a year. We just don't have that here. I mean, here is still in a state of base. I mean, you know, vaccines are coming quick. So, you know, it's coming out a little bit. But in Washington, where I live, everyone wears masks, you know, even walking around outside. And the country is still basically, you know, to a large extent, hamstrung by COVID.
Mm. We had 78,000 at the MCG last week, which was, as we read, was the biggest sporting event in the world, that people had turned up to watch Essendon beat Collingwood. Yes, okay, right. Any Collingwood supporters can talk to me later. So, Jonathan, I mean, I went to Hamilton and saw that great, you know, the great song, You Want to Be in the Room Where It Happens, and both of you, it just seems to me, I thought, you know, it's quite a good little intro for the both of you like to be close to big, powerful exchanges. I think that's something that really animates you both. You both like looking at the exercise of power. And you both had ringside seats in different ways during the pandemic, and you in Washington. I mean, it must have been incredibly vivid for you, Jonathan, sitting there being... I think you had three big interviews with Donald Trump in his 4 years. Is that right?
Yeah, two for television, one for print.
Yeah, one for print. So, and, you know, and I know that you had a few exchanges with him. And I remember you talking to me about them. And I was finding it extraordinary to hear your tale of them. And I wondered how it was affecting you, particularly that last interview, the big interview in August, I think it was last year, which was just such a fine piece of work by you, where you drew him out on his... It was. You did something that's very difficult. You drew him out on his terms. And I personally thought he sank himself on his terms, not on yours, if you see what I mean. How much did you think, did you work that through? I've always been fascinated wanting to ask you that question.
An immense amount of time, because I screwed up my first interview with him. back in 2018. You know, that was the first television. I mean, I've obviously been on television a million times on, you know, panels and whatever, but I'd never actually done a television interview. And my first one was with the freaking president of the United States. So, like, it would have been nice to have, like, you know, a city mayor or, I don't know, even a governor might be nice, maybe a senator. So we had this interview in 2018, and I completely screwed it up. I actually did prepare for it, but not well enough. And anyway, it wasn't a good interview. And so I'd spent, you know, I was pretty hard on myself, and I'd spent a lot of time thinking about how to actually handle this president. You'll notice most interviews with him are horrendous. And it's not that he just does friendly interviews. I mean, in his presidency, you look at the interviews he's done. He's done ABC, he's done CBS, he's done NBC. You know, he's done all the big anchors, like pretty much all the big anchors. And it's really, really difficult with him because it's like riding a Bronco. He doesn't actually respond to questions. You could craft the best question in the world on the Mueller invest. You know, when the Russia thing was going on, Mueller investigation, you could come up with this very well-crafted, well-thought-through, I'm going to ask this question, then I'm going to follow up with this. The way you would normally think through, you know, a line of questioning with a politician, it doesn't matter. Because the minute you say Mueller or Russia, it's a hoax, it's a witch hunt, and then he's off rolling. And blah. And soon enough, you've wasted 10 minutes of this, you know, waterboarding where he's just giving you the same, you know, stuff he's giving everyone else. So you have to think through, how do I come to him? Firstly, don't come at him too hard or hostile because he shuts down or he'll just like, you know, bang. And you're not going to have an interesting interview. Like, there are some who come for combat with him and it doesn't work. So it's this sort of, it's a really challenging thing, and you've got to kind of know him and know how he ticks a little bit to think that through. And obviously it was going to be a COVID-focused interview, but there was a whole lot of other stuff that I needed to cover, like race in America. It was, you know, during this period where we were having protests around the country, you know, against police brutality. And there were all these other things on the menu, but at its basic core, it's understanding and studying how he answers questions and thinking through how can I put stuff in front of him that he won't just click into his default.
Exactly.
You know, he's got like a series of diatribes. How do I not immediately access one of those diatribes, and how do I get him into something sort of slightly different? It's watching a lot of game tape, if you will, like as if you were sort of a football coach watching the other team play, and then just spending a lot of time thinking through not just what's his response to the first question, but what's his response going to be to the second question and the third question and the fourth question on the line of questioning.
Did you help in this?
It's like doing a school project. You know, what mark did I get in the school project? No, John, we have conversations. Other people. I had no real role.
Are you
role
freaking
in this,
serious? School project.
You're neither confirm nor deny.
What I will say about Jonathan is Jonathan loves talking things through, and he wants to kind of rehearse the things through, and he's always been like that.
The hilarity is most eloquent, actually. Now, Jonathan, what really... Do you know what I remember sitting there thinking? I know this sounds ridiculous, but I thought, my God, he's doing an Australian interview with this bloke, I thought. You didn't have... There's a deference. There's both combat and deference, often. Well, in fact, almost always, between the American interviewers and their president. He usually will drive them mad, but they think it's the Queen as well, you know, the King, more to the point.
Yeah.
And to me, you sat there in a very different relationship with him, which I thought was much more an Australian interviewer relationship with a politician.
There's actually... I agree with everything you just said, but there's actually an American interviewer who you would definitely have watched in his day, Mike Wallace,
oh, yeah.
who used to do yep. 60 Minutes. And he used to talk about the chemistry of confidentiality or something like that. But basically, when you sit down with someone, there's a point at which if you can connect in a certain way, they just say, well, we're just here. Let's just have a freaking conversation. Like they sort of almost forget that the cameras are on. And that's always the goal. And you know that better than anyone. And so there's a little bit of that, but there's also just a little bit of actually listening and not following. I think a lot of interviewing is following a script. And that's to me a real mistake because you miss the magic that happens in the moment. And like a good example was, you know, the thing that went, I mean, they said that, you know, more than 100 million people watched that interview, some part of it. Like that's how crazy it went. But the thing that went most crazy was the clip where he's pulling out all charts to show me how America's done better than anyone and all this nonsense. And so I was trying to move on. I was like ready for the next, I was like, you know, we're going, and he's like, no, Jonathan, and he brought these paper. I wanted to, and I was like, okay, let's just roll with this and see what it is. I had no idea what he's doing. He hands me these charts and it looks like something that, you know, someone's just, an intern's just dashed together on PowerPoint. I mean, it's these weird like purple blocks and stuff. And I was like, genuinely, like, I didn't know I was making these faces. I was like, what in God's name is this? And genuinely just trying to, in the moment, understand what he was handing me. And he didn't really have a clear sense of what it was. So it was this weird sort of thing. But like that was really just being in the moment and not thinking, what am I going to ask him next? But what's right in front of me right now?
So there's considerable risk taking in that. I mean, I would suggest to you that the best interviews have an element of real risk to them, which is what makes them brilliant. I mean, was it nail biting watching that for you?
Yeah. Of course. I mean, but just the pride. I was pretty confident Jonathan would be fine. And
well, the school project worked great.
Amazing.
No, I'm sure you...
I wasn't. I mean, literally, I was not worried. I was confident he'd do well. And the reason was that there was a second time around.
Well, yes. Now...
realise I'm going to pay hell for this after this night.
So... you've been, if I follow my logic through, in terms of you sitting in the room where it happens, you haven't been inside the National Cabinet, but you've sat there, you've been sometimes fairly free with your critiques of the room where it happens. But, you know, what for you, this amazing year, or that amazing year, the 12 months, the 15, 18 months that we've lived through, which we're still living through,
if I start off by contrasting the journalism that Jonathan does, and he does absolutely amazingly, which is that source-based journalism, getting right to the heart of the story and being in the room. I mean, really, it's unparalleled. And he's just carved this niche, which other journalists in the United States aspire to, but Jonathan's done it. In contrast to that, I made so what you do when you're trying to report something like this is that you do try and source information. I actually made a conscious decision at the beginning of the pandemic when I saw things going off the rails and I realized how the complexity of the politics as well as the public health, that it would actually be very dangerous for me to be in the room. Journalists talk this of being on the drip feed. And so if they think you're on the drip feed, they will drip you the stories and you'll get the breaking story. But it's the breaking story that they want you to break rather than... Now, I'm not saying that's what Jonathan does with sourcing. He does his own stories. But the risk in this pandemic was they wanted to manage the information much more tightly. And I actually made... and I could be criticized journalistically for this. I made the conscious decision that I was not going to go on the drip feed. So I was not going to try and source what the Prime Minister was thinking or the Minister for Health and so on, but try and stand back and look at, it's just a unique moment in time, and just look at this pandemic. And no textbook of public health will have to be rewritten as a result of this pandemic, because it has played out like any other pandemic in history. You can read Daniel Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year, written in the 17th century, and it reads like COVID-19, 2020. And so you knew what was going to happen next. So to use Jonathan's game analogy, It's literally, you knew where the space in the field was, where the pass was going to come. And you just got into that space. And it was just by, you know, as you said, you know, in 1990, I did a four-part series for Channel 4 on pandemics. I've always been interested in it. And you just knew what was going to happen next. And of course, the government wasn't using the expert advice. So there are four, five, six people in Australia who understand this kind of pandemic. None of them were giving advice to the Commonwealth. They were all excluded from it. But they were the people that I was talking to on a daily basis as well. So it wasn't coming out of my head. I was sourcing expert information. And so I stayed out of the room. It was a deliberate decision and still stay. I mean, they wouldn't talk to me now. But
So if you say that there is sort of a pro forma for where we are, where will we be by the middle of next year?
Depends on variants. Right. So if they buy the right vaccine, which they're not at the moment, they need to buy 50 million doses of Moderna, their new variant vaccine.
Why is the Moderna?
Because they're ahead of Pfizer in developing a new variant vaccine. Right. So the Israelis have already bought 20 million doses of this vaccine. We haven't bought any. We've bought 20 million doses of Pfizer. The Pfizer will be okay probably against some of the variants. So we need to be insured against that. But if we're covered against variants, and the rest of the world is covered. I mean, the problem here is, and you're seeing it in India, which is the unpredictable thing, is when the pandemic is running and this virus is replicating, there are about 4,500 variants in India at the moment, not all variants of concern. But if we allow this pandemic to continue in low-income countries and middle-income countries like India, we're going to be continuing to be at risk and people are going to be nervous about opening up. But at some point, we will have to open up. And that's at a point where maybe 90% of us are immunised and people aren't going to die.
Well, I've had my first AstraZeneca.
Well
and
done.
I'm very
I'm
happy,
waiting for
very,
mine.
Very pleased about that.
It's because you're a year older than me.
Nasty. See? Nasty deep down.
Wow.
In fact, you do love a fight. I mean, I don't know if it's a Glaswegian in you, but I have watched you with great fascination, and I'm sure Jonathan has seen this too. You it's almost like you relish a fight, and I've certainly seen you behind the scenes at the ABC. It doesn't frighten you, does it? Yeah. Quite right. I have to ask you, Jonathan, how you handle criticism, because after that first one, you're much too hard on yourself, in my opinion, for that first one that you did, the first interview with Trump, but you did get, there was a definite degree of criticism from the establishment, the journalistic establishment, parts of it anyway.
Yeah.
And I've never had a chance to really ask him. I thought, it stung me to read it. Did it hurt?
Oh, yeah, it made me miserable.
Did it?
I hate it. I mean, it's like, I don't enjoy being criticised. And I thought, the reason I hated it was because I thought a lot of it was, you know, based in some level of truth. Some of it went just over, you know, some of them were sort of just ridiculous. But there was a grain of truth to it, which stung. And, you know, Dad talked about just now about, you know, the danger of getting too close. And it is a danger. And when you're doing the challenges, what my goal in reporting is to tell people what they don't see, is to reveal what's happening and how decisions are getting made. So, you know, when a big decision gets made, I want to explain to people what actually happened behind the scenes, because I think it helps people to understand these decisions that can, you know, getting out of a war or deciding to go to war or, you know, deciding to, whatever it might be. I think it's illuminating to understand how it played out behind the scenes. What were the political considerations and what have you? The problem for that kind of reporting is you have to actually talk to people who were in the room. If you want to reconstruct what happens, and everyone has a motivation, and it's just a fact. And anyone who pretends that these people are not trying to play you and spin you and whatever is full of shit, because that's what they are doing. And so it's really tough reporting. And I think that what happened certainly in the first year of the Trump administration was, it was just a war inside there. There were factions, people were just shooting at each other. If there was a meeting in the Situation Room, I could find out what happened in the Situation Room within, you know, days. That's abnormal. In fact, it's unheard of. And it wasn't just one person in the room, it'd be multiple. And one person was putting out, you know, it might be an incomplete version of events to to undermine their opponent, and then you talk to the opponent, and then they give it. And so what you're trying to do is just build a mosaic. And sometimes you do that more successfully than others. And the criticism with the Trump interview was all about how my facial expression and how I reacted to this moment. So basically what happened was I had this piece of reporting. I was told from a good source of mine that Trump had been obsessed with getting rid of what's called birthright citizenship in America, which is the idea that if you're born on American soil, you're automatically a citizen. And he'd been asking the White House counsel's office to get rid of it by executive order, which is unconstitutional. Anyway, I could never nail down that story. I had one source for it. So I just thought, well, I'm just going to ask him, you know. So I did. And he confirmed it, like, just on the, he's like, oh, yeah, I'm doing that. Like, yeah. And so I was sort of like, it was like, you know, the, whatever the analogy is, the dog that caught the car or something. I had this sort of big grin on my face. And it was a terrible look. It looked like I was sort of excited about this policy, which would have real effects on real people's lives. And that was a lesson for me of, like, as a print reporter, the way you talk to sources is so different than on television. Television is a performance, and there is a phoniness to the medium where what's my face doing? How's the audience reacting to my face? And there's a sort of mode of how you're supposed to be of a serious sort of, you know, gravitas and whatever. And in print conversations, the dirty secret is, you know, if all of our print, if all you've got all the newspaper reporters and you revealed all of their conversations with source behind the scenes, you know, some of them are pretty sort of, they've got a little bit of an odor to them, let's just say, because what are you doing? You're coaxing information out of people, and you're not always doing, sometimes you're using different techniques, and those techniques do not translate well to television. So it was just a lot of lessons coming at once. And the problem was the stakes were so high. Again, that's what I say, like, you do it as a mayor, you interview a mayor, no one gives a crap, but you interview the president and suddenly you've got major broadsheets doing theater criticism on you. And it is theater criticism, just saying, how terrible is Jonathan? He's a hack. He's, you know, he's a suck up. He's a whatever and this and that. And, you know, it's not pleasant.
It was a form of blooding, I suppose.
But coming back to that, I mean, Jonathan and I've talked about this a lot, is just the difference between print and television journalism. And I don't think people in, you know, the general public actually understand I mean, I love that interaction. I mean, at one point I was going to do psychiatry, and a lot of my interviewing is about psychiatry. And how you sit, how you look, how you behave has an impact on the other person, and therefore how the interview goes. So it's actually, I think it's harder to be a television journalist than in some ways than a print journalist, because of that, exactly what Jonathan's talking about, that performance element. Because how you respond, and you can see that in the second Trump interview, is that you really, what was amazing about that, in my view, truly amazing, was you saw Trump being entrained with Jonathan.
Yes, I agree.
So in other words, that's the sweet spot with a television interview, is that they're following your nonverbal cues, and you're not following theirs. And that was the magic of the second interview, I think.
No, I think that's quite right. And I just have to ask you, Jonathan, because you also did a wonderful podcast series, I think it's How It Happened, I think that's what it's, is that right, the proper term?
Yeah.
That, about the post-election time, which I mean, that was an extraordinary time you were witness to, or you became witness to, or had to ferret out. What struck you about that time that many of us think about the invasion of the Capitol, but gee, it was a lot more than that.
Yeah, I mean, it was the podcast series was based on a written series that I did, which was sort of 9 long form narrative pieces kind of going through the final days of Trump. I was supposed to move on to Biden straight away after November 3rd, and that was my plan to cover the transition. But as became apparent, you know, within about a week, this was not going to be a normal transition of power. In fact, it was a non-transition. It was this poisonous period. And what happened was it was a mixture of me reaching out to sources and sources reaching out to me. But basically, I found myself in this position where a lot of sources that I'd developed over 4 or 5 years were seeing things that, and these are people who are like, these are not sort of Boy Scouts. These are people who've, you know, spent a lot of time with Donald Trump and working for him, and you know, they'll put up with a lot of stuff. They were seeing things that were genuinely disturbing to them. And I felt this urgency to get it out and to describe what was happening, and not like hoard it all up and do a book deal and put the book out in a year's time, because I thought it was in the public interest for people to know in real time what was actually happening. So the series I ran actually, it started rolling out while he was still president. Like, this was, you know, we're talking about behind the scenes where he's literally, you know, the last episode of this is, I mean, we've been approached, people want to make a movie out of it or a TV series or a play. I mean, it starts in the Oval Office, and he's got these hardened conspiracy theorists in there with his official professional staff. And, you know, over this sort of 5-6 hours, they migrate up to his private living quarters in the residence, and they're sort of gobbling down meatballs and planning whether they can commandeer, you know, the US military to seize voting machines. I mean, we're talking about stuff that you've just never seen before in America. And the people that, the problem was, what Trump had was, he had a professional staff that were fully willing to try and pursue lawsuits to challenge results in certain states. But eventually, it took about a week, that professional staff was like, yeah, we lost this one. This is not going to happen. And so Trump had to turn to the only people who would tell him what he wanted to hear, which is, you know, Mr. President, I've got the answer. We can win this. And the answer, I obtained a series of documents in this reporting that Sidney Powell, who's a completely deranged lawyer, presented to him in the Oval Office. These are the most bizarre, outlandish documents that have probably ever reached the Resolute desk. I mean, this is, she alleged that there was this international conspiracy involving China, Iran, Iraq, all these countries conspiring together to hack into American voting machines and flip, you know, hundreds of thousands of votes from Trump to Biden. And Trump was just eating this up. I mean, so it was covering this. I mean, you couldn't even, if you scripted this in some screenplay, people would just laugh and throw it out, but it was really happening. And there's more that happened that people still, you know, there's still a few other elements to this that I'm, you know, trying to ferret out.
That is extraordinary. I want to change pace, because I want to move to the event which posed the most extraordinary challenge to your whole family. And I think many of us may have read about that in the Good Weekend. Anna's terrible accident in 2016 in Italy, when she temporarily lost control of the electric, 2016, that's right, electric bike she was riding, and slammed into the wall, the city wall, at Passignano, near Lake Trasimeno in Italy, leaving her with terrible injuries. And it really was an absolutely appalling time, terrible, terrible time. I wonder. But the family did dig very deep. Anna dug deepest of all, and her husband Mark, who were here. But I wonder what it did ask of each member of the family, when you look back at that mercifully with 4 years have passed. How would you answer that, Norman?
Well, apart from Lee, we were all there. So Anna, Jonathan and Georgia were there, and Mark was there, obviously. And so we were there as a family. And it's, you know, everything's beautiful, the family's around you, it's a sunny day, you're lying by the beach, and then the world changes. And it changed for all of us, and it changed very suddenly in a way that you could never have predicted. And it's a blur. George and I ran to the car, Mark had rung saying what had happened, and I knew where they were, and I drove up, and everything was, you know, Anna was lying there, and the Italian system, by the way, was amazing, truly amazing. And you know, you do get into this blur, and then Mark and I drive following the ambulance, and then Jonathan and Georgia follow. And the moment I remember, and it's very much sort of internalized in me, is the um, is is that I, with Mark, walked into the emergency room to see Anna before she went to theatre. And I was recounting this back in the cafeteria because there's no waiting room and we're all sitting there. And I met the neurosurgeon who was very impressive. And I went back, we were in the cafeteria and I was recounting what was happening. And as I was recounting, and what I said was, you know, look, everything was as it should be, or everything seemed fine, you know, to trust, everything was okay. And I said, realizing what I just said, of course, except Anna. And I started to cry. And as I started to cry, I mean, Jonathan, I think, was to my right, but Georgia was straight across. And as I started to cry, Georgia's eyes filled with tears. And I realized, I just can't do this. I cannot do this.
I can't break down.
This was the wrong thing to do. And Jonathan could tell his own story from that moment, but we were all very obviously upset, as was Mark. And I phoned up a psychologist friend of mine in Scotland who said, well, you've obviously forgotten that Glaswegian phrase, keep your shit wired tight. And it's about, there is no psychological advantage to actually to catharsis. You've got to hold it together for that time. It has its price, but you've got to
internalize that. In other words, that acute emotion.
Yeah, but the family had to gather around and help Mark. Mark was doing it toughest of all.
And do you remember that moment, Jonathan?
Yeah, of course. And look, I was the least, I mean, Mum obviously flew out very quickly to Italy and was there for a long period of time with Anna and Mark and the rest of them. But like, I went back to America and I actually almost quit my job and moved back to Sydney. I thought very seriously about doing that. And actually one of the people who, you know, you're talking about the preparation for the Trump interview, but Pam Williams is you both know her, but she's a journalist and she's like probably been the most important mentor, journalistic mentor that I've had. And she was very, along with Dad and others, you know, you should not do that. You know, you can be supportive from a distance, but I really feel sort of somewhat guilty. I wasn't actually particularly helpful, frankly.
This is the whole start of Trump. So this is the beginning of this.
It was 2016. Yeah, no, I was going to come back. I mean, it was April, May, something like that, June 2016. And I came back to Australia late that year. And I just remember, you know, Anna was in a wheelchair and it was just, you know, I think I still feel a little bit guilty. I mean, I really wasn't actually there for most of this.
I mean, certainly, Norman, I must say my respect for you grew dramatically for you and Lee and Anna, needless to say, as I watched you dig so deep through these various stages. It must have tapped something, some sense of incredible duty. Did your medical training help, yours and Lee's, do you think?
I think duty is the wrong word. You just are in it, and you don't. I mean, interestingly, after the first 24 hours, I didn't think Anna was going to die, and I thought, and somehow I thought it was all going to be okay. And Georgia thought that too, and I think Lee thought that as well. So for some reason, we got into our head this was actually going to be okay, no matter. I mean, and it was terrible. One of Anna's friends came to visit, and I said, "You don't have to go into the ICU." This was in Perugia. And and she went into her great credit and found it very upsetting, and we kind of got used to it. I suppose what I did was I was a pain in the arse to the people who were looking after her.
Well, Glaswegian.
I was
came
a big
out.
Pain in the arse, and the risk is, of course, you make it worse. Just a very quick anecdote, because I know you want to get to questions. So when Anna moved to a rehabilitation unit in near Perugia, and had the reputation of being the best neurorehabilitation unit in Italy. And it certainly was very good. But when you got there, there were 16 beds of people with high dependency, including Anna, and there were three nurses on the ward. They were fantastic nurses, but there were only three. And what Lee and I did was we swapped over. We actually commuted to and from Sydney 2 weeks about, and Mark was there all the time. But what Mark and I realized very quickly was a couple of things. One is every bed, other, the Italians all had people by the bedside 24/7. The families were on rosters. And you think initially, oh, that's like third world stuff, they're bringing meals in. No, 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 it wasn't like that. The Italians don't trust the system. We trust the system. And so we, for example, hired an overnight nurse, but we realized, Mark and I realized if we went off for a cup of coffee, Anna would be down at the bottom of the bed and we'd be a mess and we'd have to call the nurses in, and it was just, you know, it really wasn't enough. So which comes back to Sydney, and that's a story in itself we don't have time for, which was an extraordinary story. But we get back to Sydney and goes to Ron Orshall Hospital to the neurosurgery unit, and it was like a palace. Three physiotherapists, one-to-one nursing. But when we get to the rehab center, 16 beds, three nurses.
Right.
How many people had family by the side? None. One, us. I mean, people visited, obviously, but they visited like you visit normally. We'll come for an hour or two a day. The Italians didn't do that. And we learned a lot as a family from the Italians. So we had rules, and Anna's friends were amazing. So were Mark's friends. Mark's friends, you know, some of whom are tradies, you know, if they finished early, they'd come in their boots and sit with Anna. Anna couldn't talk to them, and they would just sit there and be with her. I mean, it's extraordinary. But the rule was you had to do something with Anna. So friends just couldn't come with grapes and sit and natter. One of Anna's friends would come, and she'd think things through about if Anna wanted an M&M, she had to name the color, and friends of ours would come and play dominoes with Anna. And, you know, everybody had a role to play, so the people were there all the time. And you realized that but I got fed up with her nihilistic attitude.
Yes, I know. I
got
remember.
Totally pissed off with her nihilistic attitude.
Well, you didn't think they were ambitious enough for her.
They thought, I had a conversation, I'm sorry I'm taking up so much time with this, but I had a conversation with the nurse, the liaison nurse, who came to do an interview with me before Anna went to the rehabilitation, and she said, oh, what are you expecting of Anna's recovery? And I thought, what sort of question is that? I said, full recovery. And she looked at me with horror. And clearly, they did not expect full recovery. I said, well, that's what I'm hoping you're aiming for. And they weren't aiming for it. And so we pushed hard as a family, not just me, Mark did. We just did stuff. And it was us as a family that got Anna. You know, I'm not decrying the rehabilitation she got, but it really was us as a family, not me, as a family that got Anna on her feet and moving. And I did things like smuggle her out of the hospital to drive her to Bondi Junction for sushi, you know. And this is the child they weren't wanting to give rehabilitation to. Well, she wasn't a child, she's an adult. Sorry about that.
Yes. Who became very witty. I remember, I'm sure she's listening. And I think, oh, Anna's very funny. Anna's become very, you know, she was fabulous. Fabulous to see. Okay, now I just want to, ask you both, what's left to do? I mean, there's a lot for you, Jonathan. You're a much younger man, but I wonder how you would answer that. No, you know, Norman's had a great career, and I'm sure he'll answer differently. But how do you think about that, Jonathan?
This is after he has a go at his father, after the...
Well, as Normie sort of trudges off into the sunset, I think I'm thinking more about... I want to... My goal is just to do more of what I'm doing. I don't have any ambitions to be in management or an editor or anything like that. I just want to be a reporter. And, you know, I want to do more of the type of stories that I just did in this final series, which is deeply reported, longer form narrative pieces, whether that's for magazines or books or newspapers or for Axios or whatever, you know, that's sort of secondary. I just want to be doing, you know, good work and kind of doing what I've always been done, which is, you know, trying to do, which is to show people what they're not seeing and what's happening, you know, behind closed doors.
Do you think you'll get an interview with Biden?
Well, I mean, God knows I've tried. I mean, he wouldn't give it to me during the campaign. We were hounding them to give him for an interview, and he just wouldn't do it. And, you know, haven't had any luck so far. I'd love to do one, obviously, with him. And, you know, the nice thing about the show that we do, the Axios and HBO, is they're longer form interviews. They're not just the wham, bam, 5-minute cable news interview. They're actually a chance to sit down. And on television, as you know, that's pretty rare these days. There's just not usually the bandwidth. I mean, you know, I went to Ukraine 2 months ago, 3 months ago, I guess now, and interviewed the president of Ukraine, who you might remember from the impeachment trial, Volodymyr Zelensky. Mm. And we ran that interview at 20 minutes on air.
Wow.
I mean, that is unheard of. Yep. You cannot do that in cable television in America, and it's because it's HBO and it's a different thing. So that is one of the benefits. You know, this Sunday I'm going to Kentucky. I'll be interviewing Bernie Sanders for our show, and I do enjoy those longer form interviews as well. So I want to do more of that and find a way to balance writing and interviewing.
Okay. And Norman.
Normie. Yeah. So now you know what my children call me. I'm not sure. I mean, I could not have done what I've done if I'd not been at the ABC for a long time. It's nothing to do with me. It is actually about the ABC nurturing the kind of specialism and depth. So that's my home, is the ABC. And what I do, and I suppose this year I've been doing, I mean, I've always done some television, but I've been doing more television than I'm doing, and I enjoy doing television, and it has impact, and particularly 7:30 and Four Corners.
More than radio?
No. Good. No, there's nothing like radio.
Right answer.
Nothing like radio. I mean, the thing about radio, as you know, is that it's just, and it comes to that issue that we're talking about with Jonathan a moment ago. So television is a bit odd. You've got cameras, you've got people around you, but there's just nothing like, you've got your headphones on, you're in front of the microphone, and certainly now there's not a person right in front of you. It used to be in the old days, a year ago, that you did. Is that connection is just unbelievable, and that connection then gets transferred. So, look, more television. I've got a book coming out at the end of June, so you think you know what's good for you, put in a pre-order now. Maybe more books. As Jonathan well knows, I've got 2 film scripts which have been sitting on the shelf.
You're a grandfather now.
And I've got a grandfather, yeah. And hopefully I'll see young Esther in Washington before she goes to college.
What's she going to call you? I mean, you know, you.
So I want to be called Zayda, which is the kind of Yiddish for grandpa.
Zayda.
Zayda.
Oh, very nice. Okay. I can't see you as a pop, I must say. But anyway. Well, look, thank you both. I mean, I could have gone on a lot longer, but I do want to have about 7 minutes. Let our marvellous audience just probably 2 questions, I'd say. The mics are just down in front of us, aren't they? So if anybody wants to hurtle themselves to the mic and ask a question of Jonathan or Norman...
Look, thank you very much for the conversation and congratulations to both of you on the fine body and ongoing work that you do. Jonathan, a question for you. I'm just interested, as an outsider coming into Washington, how have you been able to establish the very good sort of connections and contacts that you have, and did you encounter resistance as not being part of the Washington establishment in your early days?
Yeah, it's been really hard. So I've been in Washington now for 7 years, almost 7 years, and I didn't know anyone when I got here. There were a couple of things that happened, I think. Number one, I worked extremely hard and really spend pretty much all my time source building. You know, who are the people I need to get to know? How do I get to know them? And just pretty methodically and relentlessly reaching, you know, it's not that complicated. You just work really hard and get to know them. But the more important element of it was in 2015 and 16, I sort of made a judgment. I basically looked at the 2 campaigns, Hillary Clinton and Trump, and it was pretty obvious to me that, like, I wasn't really going to penetrate Fortress Hillary in any meaningful way. I mean, it was so well guarded. every staffer, it was just so hierarchical. You know, you had to go to a gatekeeper to get to another gatekeeper to get to another gatekeeper. And there were my competitors at other publications had known the Clintons for a very long time. Some of them had known them for decades. I mean, you got to remember, like, you know, almost 30 years if you go, you know, go back to Arkansas. So it was that, or you look over at, you know, Fortress Trump, which was basically him and 10 people around him, and who had really, most of them never spent any time in politics before, and were in many cases undisciplined, or at least, you know, didn't know the rules of gatekeeping. And so it was a pretty obvious sort of decision as to where I could have more impact. And I didn't expect Trump to win, just like most people, almost everyone on his campaign, including, I believe, himself, didn't expect he was going to win, but he did. And then the next day, I sort of remember thinking, oh boy, you know, all these people that I know are suddenly going to be coming to Washington and running the country. And so that was just a weird set of events. And I think that, you know, if Hillary Clinton had been the president, I don't think I would have done, I would have worked my you know, my ass off, and I think I eventually would have done, hopefully, you know, good work, but it certainly wouldn't have been as quick and the instant gratification wouldn't have been there. And it certainly would have been a more disciplined operation as well.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Thank you. Yes, sir.
From the two respective fan clubs, the question goes to Jonathan. Where does Axios fit in the media landscape? Where did it come from? And where do you think it has an effect on the future of mainstream media?
So the people who founded Axios are the same people who founded, I don't assume everyone in the audience, maybe they do, it's a very engaged audience, Politico, which has become a very big... So Jim Vandehei, Mike Allen, Roy Schwartz, but particularly Vandehei and Mike Allen come out of traditional media. So between the two of them, they'd worked at, over a very long period, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Time Magazine, Wall Street Journal. And in 2006, they leave their jobs at the Washington Post and start this website called, what then was called The Politico. And everyone sort of was like, especially people at the Washington Post, you know, what the hell are they doing? And it started with, you know, three people in Jim Vandehei's sunroom. And they grew it to, I think, by the time they left, you know, 700 staff across the company. And they had an operation in Brussels covering the European Parliament. They had state houses around the country. So just phenomenal. In this period where many media companies are collapsing, they actually built, and it's continued, you know, strongly after they've left. So it's a very sustainable business. They were hyper-focused on Washington politics and sort of expanded out, and where they now, Politico, makes a lot of money is they do very deep policy coverage that basically is a utility for people who need to know about what's happening in energy or healthcare or whatever, and will pay, you know, a lot of money for it. Axios, you know, they left Politico in 16, and Vandehei and Allen spent a lot of time thinking through where the gaps were in the media landscape. And one thing that became very apparent when they looked at the data, and this is quite depressing to someone who I actually enjoy writing long form, and that's really where I see down the track my future. But if you actually look at the data, 95% of the stuff that we're writing as journalists isn't being read. And people are just reading the, you know, the top of it, and not, I mean, it's very depressing, but it's true, and it's an inescapable fact. And, you know, what they were trying to think through is, how do we cater to busy people who need serious news and to be informed across these topics but don't have a lot of time and just want to kind of get to the point very efficiently and very succinctly? And they built everything around this concept of efficiency. They call it smart brevity. And I don't think even they expected it to be as successful as it has been. I mean, it's grown just insanely fast. And I think we're closing in on 300 staff now. We've only been around for 4 years. I mean, that's crazy. And we are now, we're opening just local. We're now hitting local news. We've now got Axios in Iowa, in Minnesota, in Florida. We're moving into Northwest Arkansas. I mean, this is just a I mean, they are just expanding like crazy. And then there's obviously the HBO show, which is another big part of it. So look, it's part of the landscape. I'm not sort of going to tell you it's the, you know, we found, they found like the holy grail of it. It's just a part of what's nice about America. The American thing is there's so much audience out there that you can do things that are, you know, a little bit niche or in different, you know, experiment with things and build a big audience really quickly, which you can't really do in Australia because the pool's just not there.
Tragic, but true. I wonder if, thank you, I think I'll be told off, but I'm going to, if you can do a quick question, we'll put it, go ahead, please.
Very quick, I promise. I was just wondering to Jonathan, you mentioned briefly, sorry, I hope,
poor Norman.
I hope the next one's
very revealing, Dad, isn't it? Very revealing.
What I should have said project. When I'm looking at the future is that my future is as Jonathan's father.
I was just wondering briefly, you mentioned trying to get an interview with Joe Biden. And so I was wondering what in particular you'd be interested in bringing up with him. I know with Trump, a lot of it would be COVID and Black Lives Matter and stuff in 2020. But Biden, obviously, there's less coverage of that. So I was wondering what you'd prioritise in talking to Joe Biden about, should you ever have an interview with him.
I mean, the Biden presidency is fascinating. It's transformation. I mean, he is doing, on a policy scale, we are seeing policy in this country, social policy, at a scale that we haven't seen since Lyndon Johnson's Great Society in the 1960s. And the fact that he's doing it in a very boring and sedate way shouldn't dissuade us from covering it really closely and aggressively. I mean, it's really interesting what he's proposing. And, you know, they're looking at, if you total up the spending, it's something in the realm of $6 trillion in this first couple of series of packages. I mean, just to kind of give you a little bit of a sense of how amazing what's happening is, they passed this COVID relief package. And, you know, apart from, you know, the people in the Beltway who are following this closely, a lot of Americans sort of woke up and went, oh boy, they just passed basically guaranteed income for families with children. And, you know, which we have, the economists say could cut child poverty in half. And, you know, not a permanent move, something that they have to renew. But like, this stuff's just happening because, you know, no one expected Democrats to win the Senate. They have the Senate. And it's this moment of great urgency for Democrats because, frankly, the House is stacked against them. They're probably going to lose the House if history is any guide. They have to have everything has to go their way for them to hold the House at the end of 2022. The Senate is an awful map for them. You know, not just, it's not great for them in 2022. It's not good at all in 2024. So Democrats, if they don't, a lot of Democrats see this moment as we've got this narrow window to pass a whole lot of stuff. They want to add states to the union and do redistricting reform. And if we don't get this done, we could find ourselves structurally locked out of power for a substantial amount of time. So even though things look like they're wonderful for Democrats right now, it's extremely perilous. And Democrats understand that in leadership. And that's why you see this really intense conversation about the filibuster, getting rid of this and trying to pass as much transformational legislation as possible with 50 votes. So it's actually a fascinating time to be covering politics in Washington and should not, you know, it's sort of dumb to sort of just because Joe Biden has a different demeanor, assume that his presidency is boring or you know, not interesting. I mean, it's a fascinating presidency.
Look, thank you very much. Look, I mean, I think we probably should go. What a pity. I'm sorry not to get to you, but look, gentlemen.
Doesn't anyone want to ask Dad a question?
No. No, they haven't. They haven't asked him. I could.
Not one.
Wow. Do you want to ask him a question, Jonathan?
How does it feel? How does it feel?
Wipe that smile off your face. Okay. Look, gentlemen, it was fabulous. Really, thank you both very much. I think we should have round two next year.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.